Hey everybody, it is Friday, it is 12:03, you're listening to WLXU 93.9 LPFM, Lexington Community Radio, coming to you live from the north side of Lexington, Kentucky. My name is Chuck.
I'm Jess.
And hey Jess.
Hi Chuck.
Hey Jess. And we're with you as we are every Friday, broadcasting live up here on 6th Street on the north side in the beautiful Johnson Elementary, now known as the STEAM Academy. Property of Fayette County Public Schools and the University of Kentucky. And with us in the studio is a very special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm Dan Wu.
Yeah.
Hi,
what's
Dan.
Up, Dan?
How are you?
Good. How about yourself?
It's good to be back in this little sauna.
I know.
This little hot box studio. I kind of miss my radio and podcast days.
You know, we miss you too, Dan. You know, we hope you can come back, but I know you're busy.
Someday. One day.
It's probably this hot in the kitchen too, right?
Yeah, well, I have to say it's probably more comfortable in the kitchen.
Really?
There's a little more air.
A little more circulation.
Yeah.
And more foods to snack on. So,
yes.
So that always helps. So, Dan, your podcast was The Culinary Evangelist, which people can go online and check out those episodes, right?
Yep. It's on WordPress, all 200-plus episodes.
Wow. It's amazing. It's an amazing compendium of Lexington food information.
Yeah, it was been really fun, and I almost hate referring to it as a chapter of my life because it feels like that puts it in the past, but I think that's probably a realistic assessment right now just because I really don't have the time and energy to do it anymore. But I did it for about 3 years, first year at WRFL, second year right here at Lexington Community Radio, and then the third year just sort of independently as a podcast. And it's given me the opportunity to talk to so many people in Lexington, like a who's who of chefs and restaurateurs and farmers and, you know, beer people and just everybody who's doing just interesting things, any remotely related to food.
Well, I'm happy to hear
that's
that.
Awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, I've learned a lot just from listening to your show on RFL and on LXU as well.
Yeah, that's been, it's almost like a, an ulterior motive of mine when I started doing the show was like I wanted to talk to smart, interesting, passionate people about what they know. So a big part of what I kind of prided myself on, especially in the beginning, was kind of a willful ignorance walking in, like, you know, talking to Billy Webb from Chateauy Farms, and I had no idea, like, how do you grow mushrooms? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I didn't do any research. I just like showed up in the studio and be like, all right, Billy, let's talk. Talk to me about the process. And it was like a great like live learning experience.
Yeah. I think that's my favorite part of radio is this. If there's something you don't know, just ask.
Yep.
Bring an expert in, ask them about
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah, most definitely. So, speaking of which, let's talk about your ramen restaurant.
Yes.
Speaking of talking to a master, master chef, all pun intended, you know, let's talk about Atomic Ramen.
Yeah, so Atomic Ramen is my new restaurant concept. We're about a month out now. We're shooting for mid-September is the opening. We're going to be at the Barn Food Hall at the Summit at Fritz Farm, the big, gleaming new shopping center out there at Nicholasville and Man of War. And the Barn Food Hall is a really new concept for Lexington. It's essentially, you know, a food court. But it's all local restaurants, so you're not going to get your Chipotle's and your Chick-fil-A's.
Yeah, no Arby's.
Type stuff, and no Arby's, So it's all local restaurants in there. It's all really great people like Crank and Boom and Smithtown, Athenian, Pasture. So it's going to be great food, and it's, you know, it's really kind of a long time coming because the food hall has been a food and business trend that's been coming up in a lot of other bigger cities in the past few years. And it's kind of yet to really hit the South and the Midwest. So for Lexington to kind of spearhead it a little bit, you know, even ahead of places like Louisville and Cincinnati, these sort of perennial big brother cities to us, is kind of cool.
Definitely. So Dan, maybe let's just get started at the very beginning.
You know,
where were you originally born? let's build up.
Okay, so I'll give you the long short version.
Sure.
So I was born in China. Came to the States when I was a kid, when I was 8 years old. We landed in Fargo, North Dakota, of all places.
Wow.
Lived there for a few years. My dad got a job here at UK as a researcher. So we came out here when I was about 12. I lived here through junior high, high school, went to Henry Clay, went to UK. After UK, I wanted to get the hell out of Dodge, so moved out to San Francisco, lived there for about 4.5 years, moved out to Brooklyn, lived there for 4.5 years, and then moved back to Lexington about 11 years ago. Mm. So I, when people ask me, like, are you from Lexington? I was like, well, I've lived here half my life, but in kind of two segments.
Yeah. Different chapters, if you will.
Yeah, very different chapters, yeah. You know, when people ask me, like, you know, were you formally trained? Did you go to culinary school? I said, no, I'm self-taught, but I spent 9 years in two of the best food cities in America as a young person with a little bit of disposable income. So I just ate my way through those cities, and awesome. That was my food education. And in a lot of ways, like in San Francisco and New York, I didn't cook very much because you kind of don't have to. There's so much good food, and not just like high-end or expensive food. Like, you can get cheap, great food, especially in like the ethnic enclaves in those cities. You go to a Chinatown, or you go to the Richmond in San Francisco, or, you know, even, you know, Bay Ridge or something like that. There are these little pockets of just inexpensive, really great, you know, Asian foods or Latin foods. So that's kind of part of your, you know, part of my food education. Mm. Coming back to Lexington, and I guess that was 06, it was kind of a reverse culture shock for me landing back here. I was eating at the same frequency as I did when I was in those other cities, and I kind of plowed through Lexington's restaurants in like a month.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I was like, what now?
Yeah.
What do I do now? And it kind of honestly motivated me to cook more, having... I would say higher standards, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. When people, and I was kind of, admittedly, that first year back in Lexington, I was kind of an ass. Mm-hmm. People would say, like, oh, have you been to such and such? And I'd roll my eyes and be like, what, you know what I mean? Yeah. I was kind of pretentious about it. Mm-hmm. But in some ways, like, I turned that around and motivated me to, when I said, when I thought, oh, there aren't any great Italian places, I'm going to cook on my own. Mm-hmm. So with YouTube, with cookbooks, all that kind of stuff started becoming self-taught. And then I guess 3 or 4 years ago, the MasterChef thing was kind of the foot in the door that kind of kicked everything down to kind of take me from serious amateur to fledgling professional, and that was kind of the beginning of it. And then the Atomic Ramen stuff really came about. So back up a little bit. So when I, after MasterChef aired, this has been 3 years now, you know, got some renown, I got some publicity, people started noticing, and in some ways, like, my first few hires to do either catering or private dining, I don't want to say gimmicky, but it's like, hey, my husband's turning 50 in a month. Wouldn't it be cool to get that Master Chef guy to come do our dinner, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So that's my foot in the door. And then, but, you know, once you get your foot in the door, you still have to, like, prove yourself. Yeah. If I didn't make good food or provide, like, a fun experience for people, you know, it would have collapsed.
You mean, like, you showed up and they were like, okay, Ed's turning 50.
Right.
We have a cucumber and chard. Exactly. We need to serve 50.
Yeah. That would be fun. I've always actually really enjoyed those kind of like blind challenges. Occasionally, like, I'll go to a friend's house and we won't have any plans, and I'll just open their fridge, and I was like, I can work with this. Like, as long as you have more than like two Heinekens and a bottle of mustard, like, I can generally work with it. I can throw something together.
That's awesome.
And I think, like, for people who want to become either chefs or cooks, I think you have to have two very important skills. One, you have to multitask. You're never working on one thing at a time. You're always like, your eggs are going and that's got 3 more minutes left. You got to watch the saute on your mushrooms. Mm-hmm. There's something going on in the oven and there's other things happening. You have to juggle all those things in your mind. And then two is just to be flexible and be able to improvise, because something will burn, something will drop on the floor, something will go wrong. And you don't just throw up your hands and say, whoop, okay, no dinner tonight.
Yeah,
you make it work no matter what. And I think a big part of having those skills and inclinations was what helped me get through my tenure at MasterChef too, because the whole show is throwing crazy stuff at you.
Yeah,
right.
You know what I mean? Unexpected stuff at you. So I kind of really enjoyed that. So I started doing all these private dining events and private parties and stuff, just kind of small scale. I wouldn't even call it catering. because I wanted to provide that smaller, intimate experience.
Yeah.
I love, as you can tell, talking about food. So I love being able to be in front of, say, 10, 15 diners and talk to them about the dish and talk to them about MasterChef and, you know, what food means to me. And a lot of those dinners were kind of based on whatever the client wanted. So if they wanted to do a sit-down family-style Southern meal, or if they wanted to do, you know, appetizers. I had one client, they said, hey, can you do my husband's birthday party? Mm-hmm. We have a theme. I said, okay, what is it? And they said, Singapore Raffles 1927 or 1930. Wow. I forget the year, but it was like 1930-something. And I said, what? And I had to Google it. I knew what Singapore was. Yeah. I knew what that year was. And I was like, Raffles? And it turned out it was a historic hotel in Singapore. And they wanted to set it right before World War II. And I was like, what the hell?
Yeah.
But then I did some research and I figured it out. And we did these kind of translated sort of Southeast Asian and East Asian kind of street foods, but kind of refined them into like an hors d'oeuvre cocktail party kind of style. But like that was super fun.
Yeah.
That kind of challenge. But then the more I started doing this stuff, when I started doing more pop-up events and restaurant takeovers and stuff, I started narrowing in and focusing in on kind of my own comfort foods. Even though I'm Chinese-American, like Korean food and Japanese food have been part of my sort of comfort food repertoire. Mm-hmm. And I more and more started focusing on ramen and like sort of Asian street foods and stuff like that.
Cool.
So come February of 2016, I get a call or an email from this company called Bayer, kind of out of nowhere. And they said, we're developing this new shopping center in Lexington. We're doing this new concept called a food hall. And one of the categories we're looking to fill is noodles slash ramen slash Asian.
Yeah.
And there wasn't really a good fit that we can find so far in Lexington, but you were recommended to us by Tao Green from Crank and Boom.
Cool.
And Weta Michael. And I was like, whoa, okay. I was like,
like, you know, and something right.
Well, yeah, and immediately my first thought is like, I don't want to let those people down.
Yeah.
So we had this conversation, we started talking, and then the balls just kind of started rolling. And up to that point, for the most part, whenever right after MasterChef, especially, the first question people ask me is, when are you going to open your restaurant? Mm-hmm. And my answer was never.
Yeah.
Because I said, like, why would I want to do that? That's the most masochistic, painful, crazy thing that you can do, given the failure rate, given how hard it is, given how much money you have to put into restaurants. So it was just like not even part of my thought process. But over the intervening years, like I'll see a for rent sign in a vacant business and I'll peek in and be like, I wonder what the square footage is. I wonder if there's a kitchen already in there, you know?
Yeah.
And I would occasionally call a landlord and just get some information, just kind of poking around, nothing serious.
Sure.
So when the summit came along, it just seemed like the perfect fit. Because to me, ramen is also, it's fast food.
It is, yeah.
And it's kind of almost like reclaiming that term of fast food. When we say fast food in America, we're talking about garbage.
Yeah.
We're talking about garbage that will make you sick. And I really want to kind of take that term back a little bit because there's, you know, fast food is just food that's served fast. It's not a sit-down restaurant. It's something you can get in 5 or 7 minutes that's casual, that's not super pricey, you know what I mean? And that's approachable too.
For sure.
So part of that, you know, I feel like for me, like everything I do, there's also always like a greater mission to it. And I would love to be part of the growing and the expanding of the American palate. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you look at American cuisine, say 10, 20, 30 years ago, you know, sushi wasn't a big thing. Thai wasn't a big thing. Indian wasn't a big thing. And now those are all like very much part of American cuisine.
Staples, really.
Yeah, it really becomes that. Like nobody thinks of like Mexican food as like foreign or exotic, right?
Yeah.
And really like, and you get into Thai food, you get into sushi. And I think ramen is up next, you know, ramen and pho and poke and all kinds of other cuisines. And it just keeps expanding that definition of American cuisine. So like I want to be a part of that, you know?
Yeah. And so Dan, when, you know, growing up Chinese American, was there anyone in your family or any of your friends that really influenced you to be a chef or to cook or taught you how to cook?
My mom was always the cook in the family. And the funny thing is she never consciously taught me anything. but I did not realize how much I learned from osmosis and observation when I started getting into it and realizing, like, oh, I understand the Chinese flavor profile more than I thought I did. You know what I mean? Once I started examining it and knowing it, and just from really eating. So she was definitely a big sort of unconscious influence. And then when I was starting in high school, my parents opened up Subway sandwich shops. Because my dad was a researcher, and there really is I don't know what the stats are on it, there really is, at least anecdotally, a trend of immigrants who, first of all, a huge, you know, trend of immigrants going into small business. But there are a lot of immigrant, like, intellectuals or academics, those kind of professionals. They come here, they pursue these paths, and then they realize, like, oh, I can open a store or a restaurant or a nail salon or something like that. So that's kind of what my dad did. And he, coming from a research point of view, he researched franchises, like what are the fastest growing franchises. And at the time it was Subway sandwich shops. So watching my parents run what I think ultimately became like four or five shops in central Kentucky was a great learning experience, not just from what to do, but also what not to do. So part of that also, not a conscious learning effort, but just kind of watching that process and be like, oh yeah, I'm not going to make that mistake. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do this differently, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. That's pretty fascinating. And, you know, I think, it's always amazing how much we take for granted the diversity of the American restaurant game. You know, when you go, you know, for instance, like, I felt like when I lived in Japan, it was hard to get Indian food. I had to travel an hour and a half to go get some curry. You know, but here, literally, you can walk up Limestone Street and have three different Italian restaurants. You know, at one point, you could have two different, you know, North and South Indian cuisine. You know, and it goes on and on. So yeah, I'm very excited. And, you know, I think the ramen scene here in Lexington for a long time, you know, there were a few places that served proper ramen, but no one that really specialized in it and no one that took it to that next level. I think it was just another menu item because they knew people were going to ask for it.
I look at ramen the way I look at barbecue. You have barbecue places like, say, a Blue Door or a Lyle's that's all they do. And then you have places, you know, that are sort of, kind of these massive menu restaurants that where they have everything and then they have one barbecue item. I don't trust that, because for me, barbecue is a specialty. It's a narrow and deep specialty. You got to know what kind of wood you're using and how long is your smoke and what's your rub and sauces and all that stuff. Ramen to me is the same way, because it's all about that stock. And I don't think it's something you can approach casually. I don't think it can be one of 20 menu items that you have. You know what I mean? It's kind of a focus. I'm not saying people who have, like, a lot of sushi places will have one ramen bowl. I'm not saying they're not necessarily good, but I think it takes it to a different level to focus in on it. And the sort of the older I get as a consumer of food, as an eater, I've come to appreciate small focused menus much more.
I have too.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Where you don't have that overwhelming sense of there's so much to decide from.
Yeah.
So much so that it just detracts, I think, from the whole enjoyment of having, you know, a good meal.
Yeah, I think about that too, and I think about it specifically Asian restaurants in Kentucky or in the South or in America, just in general, where, you know, you have like I think about Han Wu Ri, you know, they were open, the food is amazing, you know, incredible food, but then I noticed one day that they had a sushi sign out front and was like, what?
Why? Yeah.
You know, so, you know, I think you're right. I think when you add too many items to the menu, it really detracts from what's special. Yeah.
It's a philosophical thing too, and I honestly, I don't begrudge any restaurants or any people who think they have to diversify or just do what they got to do to make it, right? Yeah. But to me, I think what's really key for me anyway too is to focus in on, like, what is your identity? What kind of restaurant are you? Do you do burgers? Do you just do burgers and fries and just nail it and not play around? And now we're going to do chicken sandwiches. Now we're going to do three different kinds of salads. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you know, I appreciate places like Blue Door. I appreciate places like Vinaigrette. You know what I mean? Where it's like, that's your focus and do it really well.
Yeah.
Because not everybody can do everything well. When I see a menu that's like six pages, there's no way you can nail all of that.
Yeah.
No way.
Well, I think that's been a cultural shift in general, just not in food, but but in our society as a whole, where I think there was a time where it was the more the better, overconsumption, too many options. You can do it all, you know. Yeah. There wasn't like your jack of all trades, not just one. And I feel like we've kind of started to come out of that pattern in recent history and moving more towards, you know, a specialty that you don't need to do it all. Like you can specialize one thing and it doesn't take away from, you know, any other aspect that defines you.
And the other part of it too is, I mean, it's an actual like psychological or sociological phenomenon. Mm-hmm. It's like the dilemma of choice. You know, they've done studies where in a grocery store, they'll put an end cap stand with two types of tomato soup. Mm-hmm. And then they'll put another end cap with six types of tomato soup. And then they'll look at the overall sales volumes, and the one with two sells way more because you'll walk up to the one with six and you're like, what's the difference between these two? And then you get frustrated and then you just walk off. Yeah. Whereas the other one, if you have two distinct, fairly different ones, a little bit higher price, one's a little fancier or whatever, you grab one and you go.
Yeah.
So in the same way, when I was thinking about the Atomic Ramen menu, I was thinking it from different points of view. One is I wanted to do a small enough menu that I knew I could execute well to not overextend myself. That's one. Two, ramen is a new enough cuisine in this town. I don't want to overwhelm people with like, oh, would you like tonkatsu or shio or shoyu or miso? Or do you want Sapporo style or do you want Tokyo style? Mm-hmm. And like Hokkaido style is this. It's like, just give me a good bowl.
Meet them halfway.
So for me, it's like it's a simplicity from an execution, from an ordering, from a cooking point of view, but also like, you know, you could get complicated and really specific and really focused on certain regions and stuff if you're in a New York City or in LA, probably, where there are already 30 ramen places.
Yeah, like Ivan Ramen.
Yeah, you know, exactly. You can do that, but I feel like here in Lexington, like, for me, it's just like, let's give people a delicious bowl. Mm-hmm. Don't intimidate them with terms. Don't intimidate them with specificity of, you know, I don't want anybody walking up be like, I don't know what to do here.
Yeah.
I want people to walk up and say like, oh, here are your choices. Literally, like, my ramen menu is four bowls. Mm-hmm. It's a pork loin bowl that's essentially like a shoyu, which is soy sauce. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I developed the broth and the type of bowl, and then I realized like, oh, I don't even know what style this is. So I started reading up on more like specific ramen styles because I know some ramen geek is going to come up and ask me like, what style of ramen is this?
Yeah.
And, you know, my answer for that bowl is like, well, it's kind of a Tokyo style. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a shoyu, but it's not 100%.
Yeah.
That's the kind of, you know. And then the other bowl is a pork belly with spicy miso. Mm-hmm. And then the third bowl is a cold, which is a take on a hiyashi chuka. That one I've run as items for pop-ups in the last two summers.
Yeah, I've tried it. It was great.
Yeah, and it's I was bound and determined to take it from a dish nobody had heard of to a dish that people craved.
Yeah.
Because it's so light and refreshing. Yes, it's not what you
summertime.
Expect. Yeah,
summer
it's not,
ramen.
Yeah, because it's not a broth. And like, I would do pop-ups. I would do like a night market or something, and somebody would be like, oh, do you have hot ramen? And I was like, are you serious?
Yeah.
Like, it's 88 degrees outside.
I get a coffee?
Yeah, it's like, okay. It's like, here's some hot broth for you. But yeah, like the cold ramen is a great alternative. And then the fourth one is whatever the special is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, keep it simple. So you look at the four and you'd be like, oh, what am I in the mood for?
Yeah.
When I started thinking about the menu, I really modeled myself after a place like Blue Door Barbecue, Blue Door Smokehouse, where you go and it's like, oh, there's pulled pork, there's ribs, there's brisket, chicken, sausage. That's it.
Yeah.
And then here are five or six sides. That's it.
Yeah. And there's that always that... Blue Door is one of my favorite places to go, especially on a Friday, but they sell out so quick. So it's my husband and I are always like texting each other back, like, who's going to drive past it first? Yes. And there's that sign on the door, just that cardboard all out. And it's always such a bummer.
Yeah. And, you know, I appreciate your egalitarian approach to ramen, Dan, because, you know, I think a lot of people in America, particularly, you know, there's so much misinformation about what it even is. And I also think it's funny and worth mentioning that ramen just comes from the Japanese mispronunciation of lo. Just because they can't pronounce the L, so that's why we call it ramen.
Right.
But what most people know of is, you know, the 50-cent packet of ramen that college students eat, and it's just a sodium bomb.
Yeah.
So the whole idea of you know, Japanese ramen, of it being this kind of blue collar utilitarian, you know, you go in, you get it, you eat it quick, and then you head back to work.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of lost on a lot of people.
Yeah. It's comfort food. I mean, it at its core, you know, the closest American equivalent would be like chicken noodle soup.
True. Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's a hearty, clear broth. Mm-hmm. It's got noodles in it, and then it's got meat and vegetables, and that's it. And you slurp it down. It's not a fancified kind of food. You can make it fancy all you want, mm-hmm. but to me, it's just like it's perfect for fast casual. It's perfect for something, you know, affordable.
Definitely.
And you also had a good point too that I didn't really think about how we perceive, you know, fast food, and how when you're in places in like San Francisco and New York City, fast food is accessible and it's delicious and it's not, you know, it's just street food essentially. Mm-hmm. And Lexington really hasn't embraced that. They're starting to, yeah. I guess. So yeah. I'm glad that you're bringing that concept of fast, delicious, good food.
Yeah, and, you know, the food scene in Lexington, you know, since 06, since you've been back here. I mean, I've been here as well, and it's tremendous.
Just yeah, the last, I would say, last 3 or 4 years, the timing couldn't have been more perfect in terms of my own personal trajectory of having done MasterChef and stuff, and that's been the 3 years, and the timing's been so perfect because, like, everything was just... You know, the curve of the way the food and drink scene has really grown here and diversified here has matched perfectly to what I'm doing. So I couldn't ask to be in a better place.
Yeah. What brought you back here in 2006? I'm always so fascinated by why people move physically.
Yeah.
And
yeah. So my ex-wife and I, we had our daughter Sophia up there in 05
in New York.
And very quickly we realized, like, wow, living in New York is a pain in the ass, mm-hmm. as a parent especially.
Yeah.
A lot of the public schools out there weren't great. Mm-hmm. I mean, daycare was astronomically expensive, and you had to get on waiting lists, you know, when mm-hmm. your kid was, like, born.
Wow.
You know, just, like, the level of tension and competition was just stupid.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, when people started asking me, like, why are you moving out of New York or why'd you move back to Lexington, my condensed answer was I was tired of hauling my daughter in her stroller up and down subway stairs 2 to 4 times a day.
Yeah.
And that's a kind of a distillation of, like, the hassle of, you know, especially as a parent living there. I think it's great when you're a younger person, when you don't have a lot of attachments, when you got a little bit of disposable income, you can mm-hmm. go out every night and there's so much to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying your life entirely changes when you have a kid, but your priorities shift a little bit.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we were like, well, where would we go? And it's like, well, we can go back home. We have family here, you know, all of her grandparents are here. And it just kind of made sense. But, you know, that said, like I said, when I first got back here, I was kind of miserable.
Yeah.
Because I was like, what do we do? Like, why are we back here? Mm-hmm. You know, like, in terms of culturally and all this stuff. And then, you know, slowly, I think you just, as humans, like, we adapt to our environments. But legitimately, like, all the things that I care about in terms of, like, culture and activism and food and stuff has really, like, grown and blossomed, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a unique dynamic, too. Maybe... It's amplified, especially in Lexington, but just with Kentuckians who, you know, we'll leave for a while. We'll go somewhere else. We'll learn a skill or learn about something else.
Yeah.
And then ultimately we kind of just end up back here using that information.
I read an article once that did kind of a study on, like, American states and talking about states that were sticky.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another term for it, but like a boomerang state.
Mm.
And I think Kentucky was like a boomerang state where people leave and come back.
Wow.
Where certain other places, like, they stay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What's that quote? Every Kentuckian I ever met was on his way home or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I've also read that Kentucky, we've talked about it on the show before too, Chuck, but that Kentucky has one of the highest retention rates of its people.
Mm-hmm.
So those who, you know, very rarely they move in and don't stay permanently, they come back.
Yeah.
If they leave at all.
From a creative person's point of view and from, like, a restaurateur's point of view, I couldn't imagine trying to give Atomic Ramen or anything else a go in, like, a New York City or Chicago.
Yeah.
The competition is so crazy. The rents are crazy high. You know, what do you have to do to stand out in a place that has thousands and thousands of restaurants, right? There's something to be said for the whole concept of, like, being a big fish in a little pond or... You know, and Lexington's not as little as it used to be,
mm-hmm.
but I think to to take your experiences and values and aesthetics and what you've experienced in a place like New York City, having tasted like real ramen, right, in New York or San Francisco, and then to bring it back here where it doesn't exist yet. That my biggest piece of advice for anybody, I think, looking to be an entrepreneur or open a small business is to say, okay, what's the thing you want to do? Is it already being done and done well? If the answer is yes and yes, then forget it.
Yeah.
Because why would you? Anybody who wants to open a barbecue place in Lexington, don't do it.
Yeah.
What do you, right. you know, what can you offer that's going to be better than what we already have? Mm-hmm. It's saturated. But if you want to come, I mean,
maybe if you open up like a Rastafari vegan barbecue spot, maybe we're talking.
Exactly, exactly. But, you know. Or a tapas place or an Ethiopian place or, you know, a Persian restaurant. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, definitely. We'll take any of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's always that risk, too, of like, you can be too ahead of the curve. Mm. You can bring a cuisine here. You know, if I or anybody else had tried to bring Japanese ramen here 10 years ago, mm-hmm. would have flopped.
Yeah.
Because you're not ready for it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it's like figuring out what the timing is, figuring out like when to kind of, it's almost like, remember the in Finding Nemo, where all the turtles are waiting for that that current, that wave was, uh-huh. and then they like pop into the tube and they ride it.
Yeah.
It's like you got to figure out that perfect time to go in, because otherwise you either get kicked out of it or you get, you know, you don't get in it.
That's true.
Yeah.
It's the timing of being a chef and opening a restaurant.
Yeah. But even doing like a service or even doing a business where you're selling something, you know what I mean? Like, is the timing right? Like, you know, if you had gotten into Lexington in the 90s and tried to do a yoga studio, you know what I mean? Like, it wouldn't have been the right thing. But also now, like, at this point, like, do you want to put another yoga studio in Lexington? Mm-hmm. Like, are you oversaturated? So there's also mm-hmm. too late.
Yeah.
For sure.
That's true. And then you can tell people are starting to add other menu items, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, sensory deprivation tanks or Bikram yoga or whatever it might be.
I kind of want to do a sensory deprivation tank.
I've done it twice.
Have you?
Source on High has.
Oh, cool.
How was that?
It was great. It was a very calming experience.
Yeah.
Salt tanks, completely dark.
I would highly recommend it, but don't forget to put your earplugs in, because otherwise you will get salt in your ears.
Oh, okay.
A little bit.
How long did you do it for?
For an hour.
Wow.
Each time.
Wow.
I feel like I need that right now, because my brain is like, you know, I'm a month out from opening a restaurant, so my brain is so just scattered to the wind right now.
I believe it. Yeah, I would recommend it for sure.
Might be, okay.
It's a good forced meditation time.
If anyone out there is listening.
Yeah, exactly.
From Montours.
I mean, that's the problem. The double-edged sword of like doing business or really doing anything in our age is like, I've got in my pocket a device that can connect me to everything that I need to do.
Yeah.
I can answer emails, I can make phone calls, I can look online and order stuff, you know what I mean? So in some ways, like, there's no office that I can step out of.
Mm-hmm.
Like, every, you know, I can be in my house, walk out of the shower, and then like, oh crap, I gotta answer these emails.
Yeah.
So something like sensory deprivation tank might be a great just way to like, okay,
unplug.
I can't bring my phone in here, so we're just gonna float.
You can hook your phone up though if you want and listen to whatever music you want, but
I feel like
put it on airplane mode.
So you feel like total silence.
Yeah,
you did.
I did.
I feel like music would kind of defeat the purpose a little bit.
Yeah, I do too.
Right?
Yeah, it's leaving one of the senses still up.
Yeah. I don't think I could do it. I'm too like my brain's too busy. I have a hard time shutting it down.
Yeah. Maybe that's why you see it though.
Yeah,
because that's what I'm thinking right now.
I feel like I'd go mad. Like I just couldn't do it.
Yeah, but I had that struggle.
Yeah.
Well, how about let's take a quick little break, just to pay some bills and play some PSAs, and then we'll be back here in a little bit. You're listening to Bluegrass Bios, and we're talking with Dan Wu from Atomic Ramen.
Wow. Live every Wednesday from 6 to 7 p.m. It's Joey Truax. The best part, it's the best part. It's Hip Hop 101, you know what I'm saying, with your boy Joey Truax, live every Wednesday from 6 to 7 p.m. You are tuned into the best part. It's where we go through all the classic flavor, you know what I'm saying? Interviews, celebrities, local artists, the whole nine, you know what I'm saying? So tune in. You are tuned into the best part. That's Wednesdays from 6 to 7 p.m., all right? Peace.
Studies show that when car seats are used correctly, they can reduce infant and toddler injury and death by up to 70%. But those same studies indicate that nearly 80% of car seats are installed incorrectly. We all want the absolute best for our children, but in the hustle and bustle of everyday life, it can be hard to find the time to learn everything we need to know about our child's car seat. Let the Lexington Fire Department take the guesswork out of it for you. If you have a child that uses a car seat, schedule an appointment with the Lexington Fire Department for a 15-minute class on how to install the car seat.
For more information on the free 15-minute class on how to install your car seat, call 859-455-SEAT. That's 859-455-7328 to schedule your free appointment.
Columbia Gas reminds you to smell and tell. Indoors or out, if you smell something like rotten eggs, it could be natural gas. So if you smell and tell, call 911 to report a possible leak.
Yo, what up, y'all? This is Skinny DeVille, the country poet, Nappy Roots representative. Letting everybody know out there, you're listening to WLXU 93.9 FM Community Radio. Keep it locked to Nappy and don't go nowhere. Yeah.
Hey, everybody, and we're back. You're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU. Coming here to you live from the north side of Lexington, Kentucky. I'm Chuck.
I'm Jess.
And we're here in the studio with Dan Wu.
Hello.
Master Chef and owner of Atomic Ramen, which is soon to be opening up at Fritz Farm.
Yeah.
Which is exciting.
Yeah.
So, Dan, do you remember when was the first time you ate ramen?
Real ramen?
Real ramen.
I think in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
So there's Japantown in San Francisco. And this is, I lived in San Francisco from 97 to 01. Mm-hmm. And this is well before ramen became like a hip, you know, trendy kind of thing. Yeah. And also, I mean, they've been around in Japantown for forever, and mm-hmm. I remember going in once and just ordering it like anything else and be like, this is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And nothing like I've had before.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've definitely had a little bit in New York as well. And then the funny thing is, like, when I reflect back on sort of the path that I've gone on, and it took me a while to realize, like, when I first started talking to the Summit about doing Atomic Ramen, and then somebody mentioned to me and be like, hey, didn't you do ramen as your signature dish on MasterChef? Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, yeah.
Well, that's cool.
And it's kind of, so it's interesting almost from a narrative, like unconscious narrative point of view. It's just like, oh, yeah, that's the thing that got me on the show.
Yeah.
That got me my apron. And now it's the thing that I'm doing.
It's awesome.
So do you know the history of ramen? Like you mentioned it, you know, it wasn't always hip. And that's true. I feel like it kind of came out of nowhere. Was there a chef or?
Yeah, it's it originally, like a lot of Japanese cuisine and culture, it originated in China.
Okay.
So it's basically noodle soup from China that the Japanese kind of adapted and made it their own.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a super old cuisine from what I've read. It's only maybe 100 years old, maybe a little bit more than that. I could be, if anybody's Googling out there, you can correct me. I'm half making this up. But it's not a super old ancient cuisine or anything like that. And then as a restaurant cuisine, it's even younger.
Mm.
It's I think it's post-World War II. And then at some point, Momofuku Ando came up with the instant ramen, where he cooked this ramen, flash fried it, you know, and then put in those little flavor packs, and then that became a thing. So that kind of took over the world. I mean, I've read articles about how that's really changed, you know, world culture in a way, and people don't think about like packaged ramen as a Japanese or Asian cuisine at all. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's almost like this fast food package thing.
Yeah, it just matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the script matter.
Yeah, exactly. So, so that guy has a really interesting story too, and this is also interesting. He Mobofu Kondo was born in occupied Taiwan. Mm-hmm. So at the time, so he's actually Chinese. He's mm-hmm. he's ethnically Chinese/Taiwanese, and then took on a Japanese name. And I believe when I was researching this, his original surname was Wu.
Oh yeah.
Oh, cool.
So there's that. So so
fate
he became
meant to be.
Yeah, so he became famous for that, and then that's why David Chang has named most of his restaurants Momofuku after Momofuku Ando. And then we developed comic book characters that are part of the Atomic Ramen brand, and one of the characters is named Ando in deference to Momofuku.
That's cool. And I believe Momofuku, depending on the kanji, means good luck peach, or the good luck of the peach. Uh-huh.
Yep.
So how sweet is that?
That's very sweet.
Yeah.
So Dan, when you put together a bowl of ramen, you know, what ingredients do you start with? Like when you're building ramen?
Yeah. So the core of it, the backbone of it, is that stock. So I do my stock with pork and chicken bones, and then sort of your classic French mirepoix of onion, celery, mm-hmm. and carrots.
And how long do you usually let that kind of simmer?
Mine goes for about 10 hours. You'll see different people's stock go, you know, for days even. Mm-hmm. But honestly, like if you, it's one of those things that what you're doing is you're turning that flame down and you're letting all those aromatics. So I've got scallions, I've got garlic, I've got ginger, I've got also kombu, which is dried seaweed, and I've got dried shiitakes for another layer of like umami, and I've also got dashi in there, which is like dried like
the bonito,
seafood
and bonito
like,
flakes
powder. Yeah. So you have all these different elements, and then you let it just simmer slow for as long as you can, and it just combines this like level of complexity where, you know, my favorite kinds of cuisine are like if I taste a piece of food and I say, okay, I get the garlic in there, I get the paprika in there, but then there's like something else and you just can't place it.
Mm.
That's what takes food to a different level.
Yeah.
Like when there's something about it and you can't place it because it's so complex, or it's because there's three tiny little ingredients that layer on. So like if you taste my ramen, you may not, you know, the dashi or the kombu may not be up front, but you're gonna get it, and there's just something to it.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's about building that complexity. And then, you know, the 10 hours is kind of a practical concern because I played around with it. I did a 6 hour, I did an 8 hour, I did like a 15 hour. And then I was thinking like, okay, do I wanna have my stoves on overnight while I'm closed?
Oh, yeah.
Probably not.
Yeah.
So what are my hours? I'm open about 10 or 11 hours. So if I get all of my ingredients mised out the night before, morning of, I dump it in the pot, turn it on, put it to a simmer. At the end of the night, I strain it off, put it in the cooler. So while I'm doing business, I'm making the stock for the next day.
Wow.
So it's kind of, you know, it's that practical balance.
That multitasking you mentioned.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's the interesting thing is if I was making a dinner for like you two guys at home, I can kind of do it however I want. Because I'm at home, it's leisurely, I'm only doing these sort of two portions, I can do it a certain way. If I'm doing fast casual where I need to turn out X number of bowls per hour for people on their lunch break who don't have a whole lot of time,
mm-hmm.
you know, I can't cook as much stuff at the last minute or sear something off. I can't make something that's going to take 30 minutes, right? Mm-hmm. So you build your menus not just from flavor and taste, which is important, but it's not 100% of it. It's a lot of like, okay, can I do, you know, how far ahead can I cook this? Will it hold? Will that texture and flavor stay good?
Mm.
If I hold it in hot stock, will it overcook the meat? If I sear it off, do I have time to sear it? You know, like all those kind of considerations. So you have to balance it. Like you want people to get their food fast, but you don't want to sacrifice too much, you know, flavor and complexity. Temperature. And the other part of it too is, you know, in my thinking process for staffing, staffing right now for restaurants in general is very, very hard. It's been kind of a really tough couple of years for the restaurant industry of finding people, particularly cooks.
Mm-hmm.
So my thinking was, if I'm going to build a brand that's eventually in the future be scalable or be able to do, you know, further locations or franchising or whatever it is, I have to create these formulas or recipes so that pretty much anybody can cook them.
Yeah.
They have to be authentic and from scratch, right? They have to taste good, but I don't want to make it so complicated. You know, I don't want to have to teach, say, a high schooler how to make a mother sauce, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Right, that requires a certain level of technique and, you know, that hollandaise is going to break if you look at it wrong, like that kind of level. You know, I'll give you like a tiny example. When I was first doing the ramen bowls, like scallion is a very typical garnish that goes on ramen bowls. Well, you can do scallion 10 different ways. And one way people do it is they cut lengthwise little skinny batons, they put it in ice water, they kind of crinkle up and roll, and it's a beautiful little thing. That takes a little bit of technique, that takes a little bit of work. There's a second process of shocking it in the ice bath. And I did it once and I was like, man, like I don't even want to do it, and I know how to do it. Do I want to teach somebody to do it? And then I just did like a small chop, just little, you know, crumbles. I was like, yeah, that's perfectly fine. And it's super easy. So we're doing that now.
And I think with ramen, you know, it being fast food, and the beauty of it is that if as long as you have your broth and your stock ready to, your dashi ready to go, it's just adding ingredients. I mean, there's eggs and, you know, the pork is obviously
the
timing.
So the stock is the big part of it. The noodles, I would say, is like the base player. It doesn't get enough credit. But if they suck, it'll fall apart.
You
know what I mean?
It's the backbone.
Exactly. So I get the unsung hero, really. So I'm getting my noodles from Lexington Pasta Company.
Nice.
From Lesme.
Which is awesome.
And it's fantastic noodles. And, you know, you get them fresh. So the cook time on there, you know, in a hot thing of water is 90 seconds, 2 minutes maybe. Wow. Super fast. So get that cooked off. You get the broth on there. And then usually my bowls will have some sort of protein, so it'll be like pork loin or, you know, belly, something like that. You have a perfect 6-minute egg that's got the like semi-runny yolk in there.
That's my favorite.
And any number of toppings like, you know, braised mushrooms or bamboo shoots, scallions, cucumbers, tomatoes, you know, seaweed, all kinds of different stuff. There's where you really have the play, because it's kind of a template and you can honestly do whatever you want with it, which is the beauty of, I think, also an American point of view, where we kind of don't care about rules as much as a lot of food cultures with deeper roots, like the French or the Japanese even.
For sure.
That we kind of have much more of an allowance of, like, let's play with it. You know what I mean? Can I put a barbecued spare rib on my ramen? Why the hell not? You know what I mean? Can I, you know, you go to Japan, are you going to find brisket on a ramen? Probably not. But here, I mean, we're in the South, so let's smoke a brisket and put that on there. Let's confit some turkey for Thanksgiving.
Let's throw some Spam on it and see what happens.
You know, hey, exactly. So.
So you mentioned that you're using Lexington pasta noodles. Are there any other kind of Kentucky sourced ingredients that you're using at the restaurant?
I'm basically saving the sort of the local and the seasonal stuff for my specials.
Gotcha.
That's also part of where I can put a lot of creativity into it. You know, unfortunately, with something like ramen, you're looking at a lot of ingredients that you can't source locally. I can't get locally sourced kombu or dashi or, you know,
even seaweed, you know, or soy sauce,
bamboo shoots. Exactly. Or not in the volume that I kind of needed. But, you know, I love the idea of going out to farmer's market and saying like, oh wow, okra's, you know, in right now. I'm going to get a whole ton of this and do a fried okra app or saute them and put them in a dish. I would love to, you know, for my specials is kind of the realm where I get to really play. And I would love to do, you know, like a gumbo influenced ramen. So flavor profile is still ramen, same stock, same noodles, but I would do something like chicken or shrimp or sausage with some okra, with some celery in there. So like, you know what I mean? Kind of play with form.
Like a tonkatsu etouffee.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think there's like a lot of room to play, and especially as a special, like I can run it for a week. If nobody likes it, I'll change it.
Yeah.
You know, if people like it, we'll keep running it. So you have that kind of flexibility.
Well, I love that. And, you know, I don't think anybody in this town could do it but you, Dan. Yeah. You know, I think the folks that are making ramen now are kind of stuck in what it's been for 100 years.
Sure.
You know, and I don't think they may have the technical skills to adventure with it, but I really think the adventureness that you're bringing to it is awesome. Yeah, and incorporating localness and kind of Kentucky. It's this combination of Kentucky and rum. I thought about this when you were on MasterChef, and you kept including bourbon in a lot of the dishes.
Right.
And I was like, you know, it's the perfect mix of like, you know, your Chinese American upbringing and that food, but also your Kentuckiness.
Yeah. One of the people who really did influence and inspire me is Edward Lee out of Louisville. He's I think he's based in D.C. or Maryland now.
Magnolia, that was his restaurant.
Magnolia and Milkwood. Yeah, 610 Magnolia. But, you know, it's funny too, like I felt this weird, like unconscious bond with him because he's the same age as me. Mm-hmm. He's Korean American. He was born in Brooklyn. And now he's a Southern Asian chef in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And I have actually, right after MasterChef, I got mistaken for him a couple times, which he's got like longish hair and he's got the goatee. So not a bad guy to be mistaken for.
For sure.
I'll take it.
Yeah.
But, you know, to be able to, because I don't think you can help but pull your personal influences or regional influences. Because I'm not, you know, I'm not Japanese. And I wouldn't even say like I'm Chinese, you know, I'm not a Chinese national who came here, you know what I mean? Like, I've lived the majority of my life in the United States, I've lived half my life in Kentucky, so that informs who I am. The other part of, for me, Atomic Ramen is like beyond the food, because the food has to be good, number one, but beyond that, like, I'm trying to create a brand that's really fun. We got the comic book characters, you know, I've really kind of jumped all in on the whole superhero themed restaurant thing. So we're gonna have some great graphics up. I want to be the first food table at Comic-Con next year.
Cool.
You know what I mean? Just why not, right? It's just fun. I want to do different events, and I want to continue sort of being connected with the local community and doing nonprofit and sort of giving back and keeping those connections alive, and also like extending that same philosophy to my staff, you know, try to pay people a decent wage, try to treat them with respect and dignity. Because the beauty of everything that I've been thinking about for the last few years is there's no conflict between doing good and doing well.
Yeah.
And I think if you're smart about it, you can do both at the same time. They feed into each other, right? So it's like, okay, I treat my employees well because that's the right thing to do, but I also treat them well because they'll stay longer, they'll work harder, you know what I mean? Like, we have that longevity, so it's like, it's selfish and it's not selfish.
That's true. And, you know, I think I love the concept of comic book characters too, and I do think that every dish on the menu seems to have its own funny character, just in its flavor patterns, and I really think that any good chef, you know, you use your food to express who you are and where you're from.
Absolutely. Like, my great loves are food and comic books and movies and sort of pop culture geekery, and when I started conceptualizing this, it was like it just naturally flowed into it, but it just became sort of more and more, because before it was just like, oh, we might have some comic book characters kind of play around a little bit, and now it's just like, no, it's a superhero themed restaurant.
Yeah,
fine. Awesome. It's okay with me.
So Dan, is there anywhere before Atomic Ramen opens up that people can come and try some of your ramen or your food?
Nope. No. I've done a bunch of pop-ups this summer sort of promoting it. Did like Warehouse Block Party and Night Market and Thursday Night Live, stuff like that. Right now, honestly, I just don't have the time and wherewithal to do anything except, you know, get this place up and running.
And remind our listeners again when's the open date?
Yeah, we're shooting for early to mid-September, so we're about a month out from this broadcast, and the Barn Food Hall out at Summit, which is that big shopping center out there. And I will say this too, like, you know, I feel like I'm a downtown kind of urbanite kind of guy. A lot of my friends are, and one of the better compliments that people have paid me was they said, you know what, I never go outside the circle, but I'm gonna come find you. I was like, well, okay, that's pretty cool. But I kind of grudgingly love the Summit. The way it's laid out, it's like the anti-Hamburg. Like, you park and then you can just walk around. It has a really, really fun vibe. You know, people are out there, you know, eating their Shake Shack or eating their popsicles.
Popsicles. I know, I had one.
really, really good. People are like hanging out, playing cornhole, walking around. So I think the Barn's going to be a really good sort of addition to that.
I think it'll be great. And so where can people go and get more information and follow you?
Yeah, I have an official website, theatomicramen.com, and I'm all over Facebook and Instagram. Just look up Atomic Ramen. Those two are probably the best avenues to find and follow, because I'm always posting like fun food pictures and updates about stuff that's going on.
Nice. Well, I can't wait to come try it.
Me too.
It's going to be great. Well, thanks, Dan, for coming in and talking to us, and best of luck and this arduous journey for the finish line is in sight.
So we're almost there. Thank you guys so much.
Definitely. Thanks, Dan.
Take care.
And so nonetheless, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a little bit with Katerina Stoykova. You're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU.